You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Telling these tears gonna fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom.
What's up, Wisconsin and beyond? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, folks, so much to talk about, but I'd like to start with not politics today. Don't worry. Of course, we'll get to the vice presidential debate, and we got a packed show for you, as per usual. We have Sarah Spain from Emily's List. She's the director of strategic communications. She's going to join me at 2:30. Of course, Sarah and I are going to talk about the debate. You can get your two cents in. Get ready to call again at the bottom of the hour if you've got input, feedback on the debate. That's where we'll be talking about it again with Sarah Spain, Director of Strategic Communications at Emily's List in the 2:30 block. At 3 o'clock, of course, as it is every day, that is when you're going to hear Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. Today, we've got Ai-Jen Poo, who is a labor leader, an award-winning organizer, author, and leading voice in the women's movement. She is the current president of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And then at 3:30, I'm really excited to be joined by Jason Stein, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We're going to be talking about the fact that Wisconsin could save $1.7 billion for Badger Care Plus if it is expanded. We could save 1.7 if Badger Care Plus is expanded. I don't know why this isn't happening. Republicans seem to be getting in the way. And we are working right now really hard to get a very, very special guest to join us in not just honor of MLB playoffs, which, boy, that was a tough loss by the Brewers yesterday. But also because it is day two of the playoffs, and in honor of my dad's birthday. I think I mentioned earlier this week or late last week that my dad's birthday is October 1st. And so every year that the Brewers are fortunate enough to make the playoffs, this is the built-in birthday present, is to go to the Brewers game with my dad to get him some playoff tickets. And I'm so excited to be doing that again this year. Now, without giving away who our very special guest is that we are trying to get on the horn as we speak, I do want to just lay out a couple of teasers, and maybe you all can guess who this is, because I'm certain we're going to be able to get my very special guest on the horn before the end of this half hour. Something absolutely groundbreaking happened this year as it relates to Major League Baseball statistics. And that is that finally, in May of this year, Negro League statistics were included as part, on equal footing with, Major League Baseball statistics. Now, folks, you may, I don't know if I've talked about this, but my dad was a pitcher, never made it to the majors. So that's hint number two. So hint number one is this, again, groundbreaking change in how record keeping in the record books for Major League Baseball are kept. Again, in May of this year, Negro League statistics included. Hint number two is that my dad was a pitcher. So that might tip you off. Hint number three, my friends, is that, of course, the Brewers' biggest I-94 rival is the Chicago Cubs. So that is hint number three. And I will say this, hint number four as to who my special guest is. He has spent his life after baseball in public service, much like my father did. And so I am so excited to talk to our special guest today. But let's spend a couple of minutes as we try to get a hold of our very special guest, talking about really what this move to include the Negro League statistics within Major League Baseball meant. And let's be clear, folks, you know, this is recent American history, right? Jackie Robinson was the first Black player to play in the major leagues, and he joined the major leagues in 1947. And in 1948, the major leagues finally held their first integrated World Series. That was their last segregated World Series. By the 1949 World Series, it was finally fully integrated. That is, you know, not that long ago. And again, what happened to Negro League baseball players and then Black baseball players that joined the major leagues was nothing short of horrifying. It was nothing short of threats of everyday violence. And it made trying to play the game, the thing that they loved, extraordinarily difficult. If you can imagine playing the sport, the thing that you've trained your life to do, and traveling, and you can't stay in the hotel with your team. You can't eat with your team. You are assaulted with verbal, just the most debased language you can imagine, especially when they were playing teams in the South. This was an abomination for Major League Baseball. Of course, we didn't even get to the Civil Rights Act until 1964, but the legacy of this within Major League Baseball is long and it is complicated. And I just have to say this, it is shocking to me. Some of the responses from sports pundits in response to the Negro League statistics finally being included with Major League Baseball statistics. Now, this wasn't a short process. The Major League Baseball announced its intention to add the Negro League statistics in 2020. And it has taken these 4 years to get to this point. Back in 2020, MLB formed a 15-person committee to help determine how to incorporate these statistics because the leagues weren't exactly equivalent, right? So you have to figure out as both a matter of historical reference, you got to verify that. And then how do you make statistics, these statistics comparable? And again, in the past, one of the sort of, I would say, fig leaf objections that had been given about why Negro League statistics weren't including with MLB statistics is that we didn't have comprehensive enough data. But what has happened in I would say, the past 10 years is that researchers and scholars of the game have really gone into the old records and scorebooks and newspapers and microfiche to assemble what is a verified and comprehensive historical record of all of the Negro League records. And what has occurred is that, you know, some of these folks have surpassed previously held records in Major League Baseball. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is one of my most distinct pleasures and honor. If you haven't guessed who my very special guest is this afternoon, it is Mr. Dennis Bowes Biddle, the youngest living player of the Negro Leagues. Mr. Biddle, thanks so much for working with us to get you on the air here, sir. It is certainly a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How you doing this afternoon, Mr. Biddle?
I'm doing fine. As I always say, I'm blessed by the best, and I do the rest.
I love that. I saw that. I was reading up about your storied career, sir, and I actually jotted a note down because I thought, I'm going to put that one into the old memory banks. I'm blessed by the best, and I will do the rest. I love that, Mr. Biddle. Can you tell folks how your baseball career began? Because it almost didn't happen. You were almost going to shove off to, I believe, Grambling State to play football on a scholarship.
That's right. Back in the 50s, early 50s, when I played, the major league scouts were not scouting black schools. This is a few years
2 minutes.
Jackie Robinson, and before they started doing it. And I was never scouted by a major league scout, even though I was a all-state baseball player. But I also was an all-state football player and all-state basketball player. And upon graduation, my graduation year, I had scholarship offers to play football, basketball, and baseball. No scholarship to play baseball, but I had basketball and football. So Mr. Eddie Robinson, who was the coach at Grambling College, called and invited me to come to the school, and I did, and everything looked great. I turned down the basketball scholarship, and I was getting ready to accept the football scholarship when I got a call from the Negro League, asking me if I'd like to try out for the Chicago American Giants.
We're going to find out what happened next. Mr. Biddle, we got to take a couple of important messages to hear how Mr. Biddle ended up playing in the Negro Leagues. You got to keep it locked here, folks. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. In honor of the Negro League baseball statistics inclusion with MLB and in honor of the playoffs and my dad's birthday, you're going to want to tune back in and keep it locked. Here on the Maggie Dawn Show, we're going to hear more from the youngest living player of the Negro Leagues, Mr. Dennis Biddle, when we return after these brief messages. I'ma keep on running cause the winner don't quit on themselves. Get pumped up, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's my privilege and honor. I'm so excited to be joined today in honor of the MLB playoffs and the inclusion of Negro League statistics finally in Major League Baseball statistics by the youngest living player of the Negro Leagues. He is 89 years young, folks. His name is Dennis Bowes Biddle, and he almost did not play in the Negro Leagues. Mr. Biddle, when we were talking last, you left off with, you were about ready to head off to play football on a full ride scholarship at Grambling State. And you got a phone call from the Chicago American Giants, one of the Negro League teams, and they wanted you to come up and try out, sir. What happened next?
Well, I really didn't understand tryout or if I was on the team. But I wanted to play baseball, and I went to Chicago, and I guess I tried out for the team. I thought I was on the team. I tried out, and I made the team. So I joined the Giants in 1953 as a Negro League ball player. I signed a contract.
And you were how old, sir, when you started playing Major League Baseball for the Negro Leagues?
I was 17 years old. I was I had just graduated from high school, and 2 weeks later, I was playing my first professional baseball game in Memphis, Tennessee. I was with the Chicago American Giants.
That is incredible. And you played two seasons with the Chicago American Giants, and then Major League Baseball called. Not the Negro Leagues, but the MLB, did they not, sir?
Well, see, you know, man, in my book, I tell about how that transpired, because Major Leagues, they didn't scout us. And I was on the Major League, the Negro League team, after Jackie Robinson, became a training ground for the Major Leagues. And people don't know this, but Bress Rickey's long-range goal was to use the Negro League as a minor league system. They don't write about it much, because a lot of our history was not written down. A lot of the stats you talked about was not written down also, because the Negro League team could not hire a statistician to travel with the team. The players themselves kept a lot of their own records. In my book, Secrets of the Negro Baseball League, there's a way thing was happening back then, because if a Major League team were interested in a player that was on a Negro League team, they had to purchase his contract from the team he was on. The team he was on would get enough money from the Major League to pay those older guys that was training us to keep the league going. This is what's hidden. This is something that's not written down about what happened in the Negro League, and this was after Jackie Robinson. And I sum it up by saying very little was written down about the Negro League from 1949 to 1963.
That is how Major League Baseball used the Negro League, sir, as you were saying, as sort of a minor league, a farm league, if you will, for MLB. And yet it sounds like, you know, this was a relationship that was very asymmetrical in economic power and who got to call the shots. And sir, you got to the first day of spring training for the Chicago Cubs, and the unthinkable happened.
Right. I broke my ankle in two places. But what I really want to say, that ended my really major league career, but I felt I could still run as fast as I ever did, but my ankle never healed. It was broken in two places. But what people don't know, man, is that players like Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Willie Mays, all was just like I was. They had that long binding contract from the Negro League team they was on, and the Major League team that was interested had to purchase their contract. It's in my book, Secrets of the Negro Baseball League, because they didn't write about that. They didn't know what was happening back then. The Negro team was getting the players ready for the Major League, because that was a money-making industry for the team at that time. It didn't last for about four or five years, but it ended up that way, yes.
Folks, you can find that book by Mr. Biddle at DennisBiddle.com. He also runs and he is the president of yesterday's Negro Baseball Players Foundation. And do you still have that store in Mayfair Mall? I remember seeing the store that I believe you've run for years with your wife, Patrice, in Mayfair, where you've got some of your memorabilia, your book, and you share some of your recollections of your time in both the Negro League and Major League Baseball.
Yeah, thank you. We do still have the store. Right now, it's not open. It will be open the 1st of November. It's called Legacy Sportswear. It's at Mayfair Mall. We moved to a different location, and that's why the store is not open at this time. It will be open November 1st.
Yeah, check it out in Mayfair Mall. Again, folks, I'm talking with Dennis Biddle, the youngest living player of the Negro Leagues, in honor of MLB playoffs, game two of the wild card, Brewers and New York Mets meeting this evening. I'm going with my pops. Mr. Biddle, my dad was a pitcher as well. Never made it to any of the leagues. But I did want to ask you, sir, because I heard that you are the man who beat the man who beat the man. And yeah, I want you to, good. I want you, we're going to have to take a couple messages, but can you stick around for a little bit more? Because I want everybody to know you are the man who beat the man who beat the man when it comes to pitchers. And I want you to tell that story. Do you have a few more minutes for us, sir?
Yes, I do. I'll be glad.
Wonderful. You're not going to want to miss it. Again, talking with Mr. Dennis Biddle, the president of yesterday's Negro Baseball Players Foundation, the youngest living player of the Negro Leagues at a very young 89 years old. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. More to come, including a discussion with Sarah Spain, the strategic communications director of Emily's List. We're going to talk about that debate when we come back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Johnson, and welcome if you're just joining us. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Radio Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I am so happy and very thankful to be joined for these segments to kick off our show on this special Major League Baseball Playoff Wednesday by none other than the youngest man, the youngest living player from the Negro Leagues, Mr. Dennis Bose Biddle. Welcome back, Mr. Biddle. Welcome, everybody who's listening. Very special treat here. Again, in honor of the playoffs, in honor of the Negro League statistics finally being included with Major League Baseball, and also a small way, a shout out to my dad, whose birthday was yesterday, who is also a pitcher. Mr. Biddle, before the break, I was talking to you about the fact that you are known as the man who beat the man who beat the man. Please explain, because this is really cool.
Yeah. In 1950, my second professional baseball game was pitched at Racine, Wisconsin at O'Hallock Field. And I was pitching against a legendary pitcher named Gerald Lefty McGinnis. He had been in the league for a long time, and I was pitching against him, and I was winning the game. And I won the game 3-1. At the end of the game, the manager, Ted Double Do the Ratcliffe, walked up to me and said that Mr. McGinnis was one of the very few pitchers to ever beat Satchel Paige. And Satchel Paige was known in the Negro League as the man.
Yes.
So, one of the players, Clyde McNeil, said, "Hey, Biddle, you just beat the man who beat the man."
I so love
they nicknamed me as the man who beat the man who beat the man.
I love that, Mr. Biddle. Yeah, that's a good one. I think you can legitimately claim that you could go toe-to-toe with Satchel Paige and probably beat him, sir. That is an impressive statistic, one that is not recorded in the record books, but an impressive statistic nonetheless. Before I let you go here, Mr. Biddle, I wanted to also share with the listeners, all you folks out there listening, that after your baseball career, sir, you devoted your life to public service. Tell folks a bit about that.
Well, I went to college and became a social worker. And I worked for the state of Wisconsin 24 years as a social worker, and I retired. I worked 13-0 year was at Ethan Allen School for Boys, where Ethan Allen School for Boys is where I loved that job because I had an opportunity to give some of my history to young people that had messed up a little bit in their life. And I felt I was helping them out. So I'm grateful for that time I spent with Ethan Allen at Ethan Allen School, and I helped a lot of young people. Even today, a lot of young men come by the mall where I am. And, Mr. Bill, remember me? I don't remember them anymore, but there was a kid at Ethan Allen School, and they remembered me, and they would introduce me to their wife, their kids, and thank me for turning their life around. And that part of my life, I'm thankful for. Yeah.
And we're thankful for your service, sir, and for helping make today's baseball what it is. It wouldn't be what it is today without the Negro Leagues and without the contributions of men just like yourself. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, Mr. Biddle, for helping me celebrate my dad's birthday in this way, as well as the Brewers making the playoffs.
Yes.
You are a Wisconsin treasure, and I wish you the best. I will reach out to you because I'd love to talk with you more about the Negro Leagues if you'd be open, okay, to that, sir.
Right. I am open to it. Anytime.
Wonderful.
Anytime.
Folks.
There's so much more that has not been revealed, even with the stats. There are players living today, stats, without shadow some of the stats that they got. But they'll never know because nothing was written down about them. I had the opportunity to play with and against some of the greatest baseball players that ever played the game. And I'm thankful for that today.
I would love to talk with you about that more. I will be in touch. We will get that set up maybe so that we can celebrate a little bit more postseason baseball as the postseason goes forward. Folks, you can find Mr. Biddle's store in Mayfair Mall. They'll be back open on November 1st. You can find his book, all sorts of memorabilia at DennisBiddle.com. And you can follow him on Instagram at Dennis Biddle. Thank you again, Mr. Biddle. All the best to you, sir. We'll be talking again soon. We're going to turn the page, folks, and we got to talk a little politics because, holy cow, that was an interesting debate last night. And I couldn't think of anybody better to talk about it with today than Sarah Spain. She is the Director of Strategic Communications at Emily's List. Prior to coming to Emily's List, she managed the reproductive rights vertical at Berlin Rosen, a communication consulting firm. She also worked as a fellow for Hillary for America. Welcome, Sarah. Thanks so much for spending some of your post-debate time with us here on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Thank you for having me.
What were your initial impressions? Because I immediately had a few. What did you, as the debate began, what were you thinking and feeling?
Where to start on this debate? You know, I think a lot of feelings. It was good to see Tim Walz up there against J.D. Vance. I think they just offered a very clear contrast to one another, which I think most people watching would agree with. Starting right off, J.D. Vance, you know, is getting in using eloquent language, but saying a lot of lies right off the bat. And I think we saw that throughout the entire debate. And I think his strategy really was speak eloquently while saying these lies, a little bit different than Trump in his debate. And so it did look a little bit different as we went through it. But again, the same lies that we saw on the stage with Trump, just presented a little bit differently.
We were 15, 20 minutes into the debate. And I'll tell you what I was experiencing was a deep sense of anxiety, like a sick pit in my stomach. Because watching J.D. Vance, that is what authoritarianism, religious oppression, inequality, racism, and misogyny looks like when it's dressed up and packaged correctly. Yeah. We have been, I think, offered an opportunity with Donald Trump because he's so unpracticed, so unvarnished, and frankly, so bad at making the completely unpalatable and frankly disgusting. He can't make it seem anything other than disgusting in many ways. J.D. Vance can. That's what I was thinking. Like, we're looking at, if we are unable to sort of turn the page definitively in this election cycle, that's the next incarnation of a post-democratic United States. I mean, whether we're talking about J.D. Vance's bizarre brand of Christian alt-right nationalism, his bowing of the knee to the billionaire bros, or his embrace of these complete wingnuts that think we need to literally burn our government to the ground. He talks about this post-republic idea. And what he means there is not post-Republican in terms of party. He means the end of our democratic republic as we've known it. I was scared. But then I was heartened by this regular man, this regular guy who happens to be a politician. That's what I felt about Governor Walz. Like, here's a regular person who happens to be a politician, not a professional politician, not a professional snake oil salesman, right? I thought those differences were so stark. Here in Wisconsin, of course, we've got a different incarnation of this MAGA version or view of the world in Senate candidate Eric Hovde. And the commonality between him and J.D. Vance is they've apparently forgotten all of the times that they have said that they want abortion banned. Like, they've had this great amnesia. Sarah, your thoughts on this, because the truth of the matter here is that these guys have extreme opinions on reproductive freedom and the individual's right to choose their health care in consultation with their family, religious leaders, and doctors.
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up. And I think you're absolutely right that the version of J.D. Vance that we're seeing kind of dressed up and hiding away some of these extremist, racist, you know, anti-women ideals is almost more dangerous than what we see with Trump, where it's very apparent. So I absolutely agree with you. And I think we are seeing this with J.D. Vance. We're seeing it with Eric Hovde. We're seeing it up and down the ballot across the country. And it all started after Roe was overturned. And, you know, we've had these elections where voters have come out in red states, in blue states, in swing states, saying we care about abortion, we want to protect it. And it's the majority of voters. And so Republicans aren't stupid. They can read a poll. And so they've been reading these polls, realizing that abortion for this election is going to be fought and won on abortion. And so they're out here hiding their, you know, very anti-abortion stances and very anti-abortion records from voters so that they can get the vote. But the reality is, once they're in office, we know exactly what they're going to do. And I think for us, we're lucky that we have the records of President Trump from his first administration. We have the records from J.D. Vance in Senate, and they're very clear where they stand. And so I think for us, especially at Emily's List, we have 34 days until the election, and we want to remind voters, it doesn't matter what they say on this debate stage. It doesn't matter what they're saying, you know, when they're talking about where they stand on abortion, look at their records. They're very clear. And I think that's kind of what we want to continue reminding voters.
It's so important. Again, I encourage people to check out Emily's List. You can avail yourself of some of the information that you all have gathered so that you can review candidates' records on reproductive freedoms. One of the tacks that they've taken, Sarah, is to sort of spin this as, well, of course we don't oppose fertility treatments. Of course, because we're pro-family, and they're sort of trying to put this really nice bow on all of this. But that's all garbage too. I mean, the courts are reaching conclusions that are inevitable and in the inexorable outcome of the declaration that life begins at conception. Your reactions to this sort of, not just dressing it up with nice words because it's J.D. Vance, right? The Ivy League version of MAGAism, right? But this particular tack that, oh, we're pro-family, and that means we want to support fertility treatments, they weren't talking about that 5 years ago at all.
No, they weren't talking about that. And, you know, I think my reaction is same as yours. That's pure BS. It's not true. It's not real. And I was at a watch party last night where when JD Vance on the stage said, I want to be pro-family, I want to be pro-fertility, everyone screamed. And the reason being, he, for the first time when it was in Senate, voted against the IVF bill. And the second time didn't even show up for the vote. And the second time was when, you know, he was already on the ticket as the vice president. And so it's really clear where he stands. And to just put these words into the atmosphere of, oh, I'm pro-fertility treatment, I think Trump has been doing the same because he sees how important this is to people after the case in Alabama. But we know that that's not the truth. They've had the opportunity, Vance specifically, to vote on it and didn't. And so, again, looking at the records, so essential in these cases.
Yeah, where were you, JD, when we were trying to protect fertility treatments? You didn't take that vote. We've got more coming up with Sarah Spain, the Director of Strategic Communications at Emily's List. Because we're in the 2:30 block, we are always talking to Emily's List. If it is a Wednesday, you can mark your calendars by that. I'm Maggie Dawn. We'll be back in just a brief moment here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. What was your most infuriating moment of the night? I had a few. Back in just a bit. Move out, don't mess around. Move out. Wisconsin and beyond. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm joined this half hour by Sarah Spain, Director of Strategic Communications at Emily's List. By the way, she also went to The Ohio State University, is a proud Buckeye, so she knows a thing or two about politicians from Ohio. Welcome back, Sarah. Folks, if you would like to voice some of your reactions, perhaps frustrations, with the snake oil that was being shucked on the stage last night by J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio, 855-752-4842. Sarah and I want to hear from you. There were a lot of lies. There was a lot of politeness, too, in the debate, right? The tone wasn't attacking each other. They attacked, you know, top of the ticket. How do you just, as a political question, Sarah, aside from specifics, I can speak, I swear. Even radio show hosts sometimes stumble over their words. Aside from the specifics of the reproductive freedom debate, on the overall tone, and frankly, politeness of the debate, what was your reaction to that? I personally thought that that worked very well for the Harris-Walz ticket. I think given Tim Walz's sort of self-acknowledged challenges in debating, for him to actively engage in fact-checking would have been really challenging for him. And I just don't think he's the right personality type to do attack dog in that sort of a setting. What was your reaction to just the overall tenor of the debate?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're not used to polite debates. Like, I think we have seen Trump debate all of these years. And so coming back to this theme of a polite debate, it almost was startling. And I think, you know, some people liked that JD Vance was being polite. And it's a reminder that just because we're seeing politeness in a debate doesn't mean that their values aren't anti-democratic, aren't anti-women, aren't racist, sexist. So I think when I was watching, I was just thinking, it's been so long since we've seen this. And I hope in the future we continue to see these more polite debates between candidates. But agree, I think it was a bit startling at the beginning.
It, weird. I mean, since Trump blasted onto the scene or rode down his golden escalator onto the scene in a real formal way, debates, especially on the Republican side in 2016 and even in this primary cycle, things have been so ugly. It was sort of like, wait a minute, are these people actually being, you know, respectful to one another? Boy, this is strange. And the oddity of that moment itself was notable to me. The fact that it was striking me as so strange that there was such, again, at least the veneer of respect and politesse seemed, again, depressingly odd to me. Let's take a caller. Cam from Appleton, you say what? Say hello to Sarah. And what were your thoughts about the debate, sir?
Hello, Sarah, and hello, Maggie. I watched all of it last night, and I think for people that aren't familiar with Tim Walz, you can throw meme after meme around about him being the average dad, the normal guy, and I got to tell you guys, it's really not a meme. It's like, it is legit. He is a human being. I describe him as like one of the first politicians that gives me no lizard vibes in any politic. And he may have misstepped, and he said that he's a knucklehead. I don't blame him for misremembering a 35-year-ago trip to a country that he's been multiple times. He's like, so what? Who cares? The entire debate, though, you worded it so well, Maggie. The pit in the stomach, because I can admit when someone I hate is doing something that I think is done well, and JD was talking. He was talking a lot better than Trump does, and that was damn near infuriating. And last thing before I go. Oh my God, like after this election cycle, can we please talk about a way to figure out how to get men to understand that women can miss periods, they can have late periods, they can have early periods. It's like everyone just failed basic sex ed.
I couldn't agree with you more, Cam. How about this as a starting point? Women are not merely vessels for carrying children. And after we bear children, we are not simply humanoids designed to provide caretaking for men and children. That women have legitimately different aspirations that include motherhood, that can be stay-at-home mothers, but it can include every single thing that a man does. They seem to have not gotten that message. I mean, for crying out loud, some of the guys that J.D. Vance follows and listens to and subscribe to want to repeal the 19th Amendment. Like, they literally do not want women voting. Sarah, how do you think that the Democratic strategy around reproductive freedoms is playing out?
Yes, that is an awesome question. I thought that Tim Walz did really well in reproductive rights last night. And it shows, I mean, he's fought for reproductive rights in Minnesota. I think it's shown truly how much he cares about this issue. It wasn't just something that he was saying to voters. He cares about this and has fought for it. And I thought it was very clear on stage that this is an issue that matters to him. IVF, birth control, abortion. He talked about it all. And I think it's something we've seen him fight for in his state. And it's very clear that he's going to fight for it for the country as well. So I think what we've seen is that Democrats are running on an issue that they care about.
We got to leave it there. That's Sarah Spain, the Senior Communications Director for Strategic Comms at Emily's List. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Back with Maggie and the Millionaires after these messages.
Must be exhausting, always rooting for the anti-hero.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.